The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie Leconte.
Our guest this week is Miranda Green. Miranda is a journalist for the Financial Times. Hello, Miranda.
Hello.
You are the former press secretary to Lib Dem leader Paddy Ashdown. You've written for, among other things, Newsweek, The Times, The Observer, The Sunday Times, Intelligent Life, and you're regularly on our TV screens. But what I'm really interested in is your time at Westminster School.
Oh, why so?
Well, Westminster School is great, as listeners to the podcast both know. We have gone to some effort to stalk, when I say we, I mean I.
I have nothing to do with this.
To stalk our guest background. And what's always interesting about Westminster School is...
You looked at Wikipedia.
Yes, you do, that's it. And then Google, then going back to Wikipedia. Yeah. What's great about Westminster School is you have these amazing eras of people who are largely unconnected in their adult life, but they were at school at the same time. And so the years, for instance, that Adam Bolton, Chris Hoon and Shane McGowan from the Pogues were all at Westminster at the same time, that must have made for some incredible, incredible school plays.
Yeah, nobody believes the Shane McGowan one either. So,
well, I see. Because it seems so unlikely.
But
when
it's
I
true.
Was prepping for this show, I could have spent a lot of time looking up Angela Merkel and the budget, but instead, I spent most of the time on Google trying to find this to disprove the Shane McGowan thing. But it is remarkable. Then there was the Helena Bonham Carter, Nick Clegg, and Ruth Kelly era. Again, quite an important one. Were you there for the Louis Theroux, Dido, and Adam and Joe show?
I was.
You were?
That is my era.
That's your era. So you are very much the that era.
Yeah. I'm appalled to say that I wasn't friends with any of them. So I'm
were
like
you just
I'm slightly
too cool?
limited.
No. You sort of Dido, she's so square.
No. I mean, it was very interesting with she wasn't known as somebody who was doing music at that point. But then of course, you know, we all sort of blinked. And she was a massive international superstar. So that was kind of quite exciting. And also, there were quite a few... The girls were really intimidating, actually. And some of them were kind of, you know, doing Vogue modelling in their spare time and all of this. So I sort of used to cling to the walls a bit when I was there, actually, to be honest.
I can just imagine the kind of questions that Louis Theroux would come up with in school. But the girls at Westminster School, did you board in the boarding house?
No, I lived in London and I was a day pupil just for the 2 years of sixth.
The only reason I ask that is, interesting fact, and I say interesting in the broadest possible sense, the boarding house for the girls used to back onto the garden in which YouGov's first office existed.
That is really not interesting.
and also, unless
there's something slightly odd coming up.
Also backing onto that garden was the Lib Dem headquarters. And so you'd have this strange mix of...
Nerds and nerds.
Yeah, exactly. Westminster girls, YouGov nerds, and
Liberal Democrats.
leaning out. Happy times.
Happy days in Cowley Street.
Yes, yeah. Moving on then. speaking of women who you just blink and they become international superstars, Angela Merkel.
Yes. Yes.
She has.
Really? That was a great link.
If you like that, you'll love the later ones. She's announced that she will not seek re-selection as chair of the Christian Democrats in Germany, but she will remain as chancellor until her term ends in 2021. Her announcement comes after the result of the election in Hessen, where her party suffered its worst result since 1966. In terms of British public opinion, she's consistently the most popular major foreign leader. What does this mean? Miranda?
Well, she's had this sort of steady hand for a long time and has often seemed to be the kind of only sober grown-up in the room in international politics in recent years. So, I mean, I think she'll be much missed on lots of levels. But it has to be said, particularly in recent years, during the whole Brexit saga, Britain seems to have misread Merkel quite a lot. I mean, she's obviously, as you said, Joe, she's going to remain in place as Chancellor for another, you know, between 2 and 3 years. So it won't be an immediate change. But, you know, we've relied in this country way too much on the idea that Angela will swing it for us, and, you know, Brexit won't be such a catastrophe because the Germans will back us, and particularly Merkel, who's had a good relationship. You know, I mean, Cameron seemed to think that Merkel was going to just fix everything for him. And then here we are now, 2.5 years later, and nothing is fixed at all. And there was this, do you remember, there was always this awful thing that supposedly she regarded Cameron as a sort of favourite nephew. I mean, it was all slightly cringe-making at the time.
And what did he do to repay that? Give her a box set of Midsummer Murders. I mean, that is exactly what you give the aunt who you don't know what to get for at Christmas. Yeah, old Midsummer Murders.
Didn't she, like, one of my favourite Merkel facts, I can't remember what birthday it was, but she had a big birthday party for, like, a big birthday not that long ago. And I think that, so the actual party was a one-hour-long lecture by a Nobel Prize winner.
Sensational.
In something, yeah, and that was the party. It was just a very long lecture on some type of physics.
She's sort of uncompromising, isn't she, in her you know, the terrible jackets, the refusal to sort of change anything about herself while just doggedly carrying on. You know, I think we will miss that, actually. We don't know what will come after it, as you say, but...
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Angela Merkel.
Angela Merkel who?
Angela Merkel. That's my Angela Merkel joke.
I think it'll be interesting at EU level as well. So you've got people like Macron, who I think has relied quite heavily on Merkel as well, and Macron, who really wants to reform the EU and kind of shape it in a different way, and I think was very much counting on that kind of like French-German alliance. And actually, it's really unclear. I mean, A, he's not done a really good job of it so far, but B, without Merkel there, I have no idea how he's going to be able to do anything, I think, at EU level.
And similarly, I think Theresa May always thought that she'd be negotiating Brexit with Hillary Clinton and Angela Merkel, and it looks like that's not going to be the case. So what does this mean for Brexit, do you think, Miranda?
Well, you know, it depends how much. I mean, Merkel's sort of power has already been on the wane in Germany and in EU circles even before she made this announcement this week. And I think that's already affected the Brexit process because she hasn't been able to fix it. So I think you know, you'll just see... The idea that the UK can rely on the Germans to kind of herd everyone else in the EU conveniently towards a deal that's favourable to the UK is utterly sort of irrelevant now.
Do you think she'll last until 2021, given that the announcement's been made? I mean, that's a long lame duck period.
It is, isn't it? And it's also the things that have brought her down, i.e. the kind of collapse of the two main centre parties, the centre-right party and the centre-left party, the growth of the Greens, the AFD, you know, voters kind of splintering towards the edges. You know, if that trend sort of continues, it'll just increase the pressure all the time on her ability to kind of guide the governing coalition through. So maybe she won't last a full term.
For legal reasons, we're not going to have any segue into the next piece. Peter Hain. Last week, he used his parliamentary privilege to name Philip Green as the man who had taken out an injunction against allegations of inappropriate behaviour. Now, we are not going to discuss those allegations in detail, but what I'm interested in is this idea of using parliamentary privilege. Back in 2011, John Hemmings did the same thing when he named Ryan Giggs as the footballer allegedly involved in an affair. Now, at the time, there were surveys done that showed that 82% of people said they knew who the footballer was. And 79% of those correctly named Ryan Giggs. So you had this situation where basically everyone knew who was involved with it. Many people in the public knew. Is there any future for injunctions if people know about these injunctions? Is this just going to happen as a matter of course now?
Well, the thing is, what happened with the sort of super injunctions during that whole Ryan Giggs era when Hemmings stood up and named him, there was a kind of rash of them. And so there were this sort of consensus arose that they were being wildly overused. And in the end, what happened was that there was a kind of round table between the legal bods and political bods and media bods. And they sort of agreed a way to treat them. And then they did sort of collapse. And actually now you don't hear about super injunctions quite so much. So maybe the same thing will happen over NDAs.
Do we not hear about them because they're actually just better at not being heard about?
No, I think there's always a rumour. I mean, newsrooms are full of things you can't print, right, Joe?
As someone, I mean, obviously I might be biased because I'm literally writing a book about that stuff at the moment.
Oh, you're writing a book at the moment?
So I am. I feel like I never mention it. So
no,
I thought that maybe, you know, like big news.
It never comes up.
No, I know. But, you know, genuinely, I think that, you know, as Miranda said, most injunctions, I remember when I was at Telegraph a few years ago, like, we all knew about them, you know, everyone knew about them. And so I don't think that anyone could actually become so good at secret injunctions that somehow no one would find out.
And in the era of social media, I mean, going back to 2011, there was that Twitter account that basically just named everyone who was involved with Super Injunctions. We won't do that here, even for comic fan. Actually, we could do it and then just bleep it out. We'll just make stuff up. What should we make up? Let's not do that. Do you think in the era of social media, secrets can be kept? Or are people just going to be found out? And what if there's... And the other thing I'm interested in, what if there's a false allegation now?
I think there are always loads of secrets that don't get found out. I mean, Marie's excellent book, which she's working on, for example, will presumably show...
I did interview Miranda,
yeah. I mean, I think actually one of the things I found going from the kind of inside side of politics as an advisor, then going back out again to be a journalist again, because I was a journalist before as well, actually there's loads of stuff that never comes out. But when it comes to a sort of big scandal like the one that Peter Hain decided to explode into the public arena in the House of Lords, I think nowadays it becomes really almost untenable to do this and to shut people up. I mean, for me, transparency is always going to sort of be my bias, particularly if it's about sort of some powerful person and their abuses. But I do think there's something worth thinking about, though, which is that sometimes in cases where somebody has been done wrong, there is a kind of bilateral agreement, yes, a payoff, but also an agreement to sort of settle and move on. And I'm not sure in every single case it would help the victim for it to be sort of radical transparency and go through the courts, because that could actually have very bad effect on individuals as victims. So I'm slightly less black and white about the whole NDAs thing than some people.
But also, if I remember correctly, I think that two of the women around the allegations about Philip Green did say that they did not want to be named and kind of wanted the thing to go away.
Frankly, they didn't want to be in the papers.
And yeah, and it was the thing as well, so like to come back with parliamentary privilege, maybe controversially, I'm not sure. I don't think he should have said it when he did, because there was still, my understanding, it was still an interim injunction and there was going to be another hearing. And actually, you know, I think that at that point, like, surely for me, I think that parliamentary privilege is about like when all the other possible avenues have been kind of explored and everything, then, you know, and parliamentarians still feel strongly that there is a case in making a name public, for example, then fine. But at that point, I think the courts had not, you know, had not gone through the entire length of the proceedings. So,
and questions have been raised about the relationship that Peter Hain has with the with some of the people involved.
That's also something someone told me the day before, and I was like, oh, that's quite interesting. And then the next day, big story on Legal Cheek, and I was like, again, yeah, that was a story. Could have given that to someone. That was so good. I'm not in news anymore. Anyway,
it's great though, isn't it? We're all sounding like the oldest members of the House of Lords saying about the relatively young Peter Hain, bit of a hothead. But that it does actually seem to be the correct assessment of what he did.
Can I say that I love the fact that he named him, the Lords kind of like moved on in the chamber, the Telegraph had over 20 minutes to write it up as a story, as a massive scoop. No one had noticed that someone had said it in the House of Lords. They had the time to publish it as an exclusive because no one watches the House of Lords.
Bring back parliamentary reporting.
Bring back Esther Webber.
Yes, indeed.
Do you think that we will see a reduced use of injunctions now because people just think it just attracts more attention than it's worth? Or do you think it will depend on the specifics of the incident? I'm thinking of what the Americans called the Streisand effect, whereby an attempt to hide or remove or censor a piece of information has the unintended consequence of actually making it far more publicised than it would have been originally.
Yeah, I'm sure there's something to that, particularly with social media, because you excite people's interest, don't you? If you make it clear that there's something buried in this particular part of the wood, then people will get their spades out and start digging.
Speaking of things that will excite the public, the new Brexit coin was announced in the budget. This is a 50p coin which will be launched in spring 2019 and will feature the phrase "friendship with all nations." Now, we do have form on this in this country. In 1998, a 50p coin was launched to coincide with Britain's presidency of the EU. I'm sure we all remember that.
Oh, absolutely. I've got several stashed away.
I will only be spending those coins from now on. But The Sun has hailed this as a victory after they campaigned for the government to create an enduring gesture to mark Brexit as a landmark national moment. Sometimes I get the feeling that the government does things specifically to generate internet memes. What do we think about this?
Actually, on a brief, serious point, and I'm shamelessly stealing an opinion from Twitter here, but someone mentioned that they think, I think it was Sam Lowe, the think tank guy who mentioned that he thinks that means the government might be about to cave in on the backstop, and actually, which is why they're putting the coin out, the backbenchers are going to be happy, because story backbenchers are fucking weird. They'll be happy about that and then be like, oh yeah, new coin, by the way, we've agreed to something. Anyway, what? Did someone say something? No, new coin, which, you know, maybe. That's my only opinion on this. I don't care about the coin.
you won't be running out to get one. I imagine it's too early to have public opinion data on this, but I imagine that, like so many things around Brexit, it will fall firmly in line with what side of the argument you are on. Miranda,
yeah,
do you think
yeah,
this
probably.
Is important?
No, I don't think it's important.
That's the spirit.
Is it silly? Yes. Yeah, the memes are quite good. You know, the sort of spirit that I suppose they're trying to embody on the coin is sort of buck up, you know, everything's going to be great.
And that would be amazing, handing out a coin with everything is going to be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry, you know, and probably lots of us kind of think it should say, abandon hope, all ye who enter here, but you couldn't probably put that on a coin anyway, so that's why I didn't get the job of designing the coin.
I think they should just put it to a Twitter design, just allow people to send it.
Coiny McCoin face, I'm afraid, would be the result.
Which is why it would be amazing to do. We're joined now for our weekly chat with Sarbjit from Smarkets. Hello, Sarbjit.
Hi there, how are you doing?
Yeah, we're all doing well here. One of the things we've been discussing is Angela Merkel leaving as head of the CDU. Is this an area where there will be a lot of betting coming in?
Well, we hope so. We've got a market up on that, looking at who's going to succeed her in the CDU. Merkel going is kind of significant for the whole party and the country in a way, because she's been seen to take the CDU more towards the left. And the question is, do the CDU want to replace it with someone more on the right? So we've got like her protege, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, a.k.a. AKK.
Oh.
Which is a nice one.
Oh, sorry.
A.k.a.
Oh, yeah, it's been a long day. I was struggling to work out how that works. But yes, A.k.a. AKK. A-K-K.
Yeah.
Say the name again. Don't worry.
So she's the market leader at 63%. But we've got two other people, Friedrich Merz, a longtime Merkel rival, with a strong following amongst CDU traditionalists, who's second place, and then Jens Spahn, who's on the Weiter Party, open homosexual, lives in Berlin with his partner, and using maybe his, you know, his openness to kind of take more harder right positions within the party. He's for the banning of the burqa, opposes dual citizenship and tax increases, and he's been a critic of Merkel's refugee policies.
Doesn't sound great. <What's interesting, laughs> not a fan, personally.
Given that the CDU has been consistently against gay marriage, I mean, you know, really pushing the sort of the Christian bit of that, it's interesting.
Well, AKK is against gay marriage and abortion.
Oh, right. We're in the US for next week in a special episode, sort of live from the United States. We've discussed over the last few weeks some interesting races. Do you have any more for us to pay attention to?
Yes, well, my favourite on this whole thing is the Georgia gubernatorial race, where you've got Brian Kemp of the GOP versus Stacey Abrams. If Abrams wins, she'll be the first female African-American governor in US history.
Oh, that is really cool.
And what does the betting on that look like at the moment?
Well, it's a coin toss at the moment. Abrams trading at 46% against Kemp. Even though the Democrats have never won a major statewide office in Georgia since 2000, it looks like she might win. Kemp's a kind of far-right conservative who's won his primary campaign in an anti-immigrant pro-gun message and with endorsement of Trump. Yes.
How about immigrants are good, but guns are bad? Just a thought.
It's pretty radical there.
It certainly would be pretty radical there.
Abrams focused on the traditional Democratic issues such as education and healthcare. And the big issue in this race is around voting rights. Abrams is an expert on voting rights, and specifically on Georgia. And she's constantly called on Brian Kemp to step down from his role, because while he's been Secretary of State for Georgia, he has cancelled over 1.4 million voter registrations.
Yikes.
That's since 2012. But if you just look at since 2017 alone, it's been 600,000. Kemp accused his opponent of trying to encourage illegal voting. And Abrams kind of has a really excellent reply, which I won't even summarise. Just go check it out on the internet. She's very erudite. She's a very intelligent woman. It'd be great if she wins this race for all kinds of reasons.
Your biggest markets leading up to the midterms are the Senate and the House race and the overall result. There's been some movement and speculation, certainly on the other side of the pond, about where things might go. What is the betting showing?
Well, it's looking like the Senate is going to stay Republican and the House of Representatives will swing to the Democrats. There's kind of simple reason for this. The Senate is made up, obviously, of 100 seats. And of those 100 seats, only 35 are up for election in this cycle. And 27 of those seats are ones that Democrats hold. 8 are ones that Republicans hold. And currently the split in the Senate is 47 seats for Democrats and Republicans have 51 seats with 3 independents. So to keep a majority, the Republicans only need to hold on to the 8 seats. Democrats need to hold on to 27 seats and win 4 more races, which is kind of why it's not predicted to swing too much.
Yeah, the numbers don't lead towards that. But what about the House?
Yeah, for the House is different because there's 435 representatives, which currently stand at 187 Democrats versus 246 Republicans. But all the seats are up for election. So we're looking at a House majority for Democrats at 63%.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Sarbjit, thank you very much. We'll speak to you again next week.
Thank you.
Our main topic of discussion this week is, of course, the awe-inspiring excitement that is the budget.
Ooh, ooh.
Now, we had Phil Cowley on in previous weeks, and he said that he would do away with the budget entirely. Stephen King, not that one, writing in the Evening Standard, said that budgets have simply lost their mojo. In the era of extensive briefings, is there any point to budgets anymore? On a general point, before we start dealing with this year's?
I quite like it, but then I'm sort of, I quite like fixed moments, and I quite like parliamentary theatre, and I quite like the moments when you can sort of assess and take stock of how each team is doing, you know, how their kind of principal players have the support or lack of it from the benches behind them. And also in a sort of substantive way, you do get all on the same day, how well is the economy doing? Is growth what we think it should be? What's the government's plan to solve that? What's the government going to do with the money it does or doesn't have from tax receipts? You know, are the government's priorities the right priorities for the country? So I know it's really sort of fashionable to say do away with all the fixed points in the political year. I would kind of agree on party conferences, which I think have just become utterly unbearable. I quite like the budget. I think it performs a function still.
Mm. No, actually, I agree. And I think it reminds me of PMQs, as was mentioned in our second episode with Tom Hamilton, in that if you watch PMQs from the outside, it's a bit, okay, well, you know, what's the point of that? But actually so much about it is about party discipline, is about knowing who's up, who's down, and where, like, in that case, the Chancellor stands, I think. And also, I think, gives a chance for backbenchers as well to have, you know, basically saying, you've got those weeks. If there's something you want in the budget or, like, something you feel strongly about, you can go talk to the Treasury and you feel like you're being heard. And, you know, maybe you'll end up in the budget, maybe you will not, but at least, you know, you're kind of, you know, channeling your frustrations, etc. So I think the internal politics of it is nearly more interesting than the budget itself.
And when it comes to the specifics of this year, Philip Hammond went in actually not that badly viewed by the British public. He has a net approval rating of minus 12 once you exclude the don't knows, and that is obviously not great, but it's better than the Theresa May score of minus 24 or Jeremy Corbyn of minus 28. So he was in a relatively good public opinion position. And when you ask people who would be best for the economy in this country, would it be a government led by May and Hammond or a government led by Corbyn and McDonnell? May and Hammond take it 41 to 30%, and we know the economy is still an important thing. We obviously had all of the announcements, all of them. The era of austerity is finally coming to an end. Extra $2.5 billion for the NHS over 5 years, $30 billion for roads and potholes, raising personal tax allowance, the high rate of income tax, 2% digital services tax on big companies, increasing the national wage, 500. Anyway, what do you think, Miranda, the most important announcements were yesterday?
So I thought the kind of his smug ability to bring forward the tax cuts that they'd promised in the Tory manifesto was probably quite significant. And in fact, this morning, the day after, because we're speaking the day after, Labour has sort of been forced to say they wouldn't reverse them, which makes it a win for Hammond doing it, really. So I think that was quite significant. I think what they would hope is that imposing a digital tax on the big tech giants, combined with a kind of package to try and save the British high street, which is dying on its feet at the moment, might start to have an effect in the kind of towns and cities and regions of the UK which feel very neglected, that even if they can't solve the problems immediately of local communities, at least they're doing something to try and sort of tackle that feeling of kind of communities falling apart. So I think he did quite well, actually. If you think that the background of Brexit is so chaotic, his job was to sort of remind people why they ever voted Tory. And that's all to do with a feeling of kind of economic competence and looking after people and people giving back, being given back their own money to spend through tax cuts. So, I mean, you know, there's always some disaster in the budget that emerges in the 2 or 3 days afterwards, but it was pretty competent performance and package. And, you know, competence ought to be one of the key Tory brand values, and Brexit has nearly trashed it. So to reclaim some of that is quite a valuable task for Hammond personally to do for them.
But also I think that it was welcomed really well by the press, which I was not really expecting, especially with a kind of, you know, right-leaning press, which, yeah, again, was not a given. And I think it'll be quite interesting to see, because I think in the background there's quite a lot of like Tory backbenchers who really do not like Hammond, but to a point I'd not really realised before, I think, because he's just quite a bland man, and it's really weird to have very strong feelings about him. But then if you talk to some Tory MPs who, you know, otherwise not that mad, they, like, some of them loathe him. And so I wonder because lack of imagination, because he's dull, because they say, you know, like, it's not just about Theresa May, it's the idea that we have this cabinet which, you know, doesn't have enough ideas, enough, you know, basically saying, you know, we're kind of sliding towards electoral defeat because they have nothing to offer. So I wonder if actually that budget will not have changed that, partly because, you know, he did get some good headlines. There was actually stuff in there. Obviously, the jokes were appalling, but, you know, that's another thing. So I wonder, yeah, that'll change his standing among the kind of like parliamentary Conservative Party.
Miranda, you mentioned the fact that in previous years, in the following days, problems have occurred, most famously the problems for George Osborne's budget that left the Omni shambles and the pasty tax and all that sort of thing.
Those were the days, I tell you.
Yeah, happy days.
Happy newsrooms,
with,
yeah.
Obviously, periods of deep, dark depression. Do you think there's any possible missteps coming up around any issues this time around?
Well, I think the missteps are already visible in terms of the politics of it. One of them yesterday, which I got very irate about, and many other people have done as well, was he managed to turn giving £400 million for schools into a terrible own goal by describing it as to spend on the little extras. You know, anyone with children
like
in a state school, anyone with children in a state school knows that, you know, the funding cuts are really quite serious. And it's not about sort of buying some extra art materials. It's about whether you can keep your teaching assistants in the classroom. And that sort of political tin ear is a sort of indicator of the much more fundamental problems that the Tory party is going to have. He's not the first Chancellor to have poor peripheral vision. They do have a tendency to that. I mean, you talked about George Osborne's famous budget mess-ups, but I mean, even Gordon Brown, the great, famously great clunking fist at the Treasury, he had terrible sort of, you know, political blind spots which would come back to haunt them a few days after budget. So this is something that happens to chancellors. They kind of lose sight of the things that sound awful to the general public.
Was it Osborne? I think that was one of my favourite ones, the beer and bingo tax relief or something.
So patronising.
Did you run that past anyone? Did you? Anyway.
Obviously, the main emphasis was on the idea that the era of austerity is behind us. Miranda, is that true?
Well, everybody's focused on his use of the continuous present tense. Austerity is coming to an end. That is a continuous present tense that could go on for some time, and it's not the same as saying austerity is over. And if you look at things like the welfare cuts, you know, there's a lot that's still to happen next April, which will hit people hard. So there's a massive danger for the government that they've kind of raised expectations about austerity being over when it isn't really. But on the other hand, you know, he's been able to afford these tax cuts. He's been able to afford to say, I've got this £15 billion bung, which if Brexit goes well, I will then spread across the public services to delight you all. So it's still that sort of light at the end of the tunnel feeling rather than days of wine and roses.
And there was a lot of emphasis on universal credit, a lot of information about that, the fact that it is, quote, here to stay. Have the government gone too far down that road to roll back now? And do they have a explosion just waiting to happen further down the line?
I think the universal credit mess could be the thing that eventually does for them, actually, if it continues to go wrong, combined with the other welfare freezes and welfare cuts, because, you know, this is a lot of people and this is their natural voter base. This is potentially a lot of people who came over to them last time. I mean, you'll be better informed on this than me, Joe, but So one of our FT columnists, Tim Harford, the statistics guru.
For more or less. Tim, I know you're listening. Please come on our podcast.
Do listen, Tim. He wrote a fantastic column for us last week, which compared Brexit to building the Sydney Opera House. The idea being, with these kind of mega projects, you either end up with a very expensive masterpiece, which becomes the eighth wonder of the world, or you have a terrible hole in the ground where your only choice is to keep on digging and keep on digging and throw more money into the hole and then keep on digging. You know, with universal credit, it's on such a huge scale. You know, is it the Sydney Opera House that solves the welfare issues that the UK has been trying to solve since the 90s? Or is it a huge hole in the ground?
Or would it be something more akin to the Millennium Dome in that it's built, everyone hates it. But then after a while you think, oh, actually, we could use it for something else. And it's actually quite good. And my goodness, there's a Nando's and a gourmet burger kitchen.
So no, I'm really cross because I was going to make exactly the same joke. But yes,
I think of another one now.
I only have like three jokes, famously. But I think it's quite interesting. So the Tory MPs who were really vocal about universal credit are already split again on that. So you've got some like Johnny Mercer, who I think is taking it, saying, I think the line is, you know, Philip Hammond has saved universal credit. And so people like him are happy. I think Heidi Allen, who has been the most consistent kind of voice against universal credit on the Tory benches, has already said, I think that's not enough money. Because my understanding is that he's only put back about half the money Osborne had taken away. So it's not clearly like taking it back to the kind of original plans. So even in the internal stuff, I'm not sure how they'll go. But I think the Tory backbenchers seem happier now than they were 2 days ago about it.
When you ask people which party is best able to deal with the issue of welfare and benefits, Labour are ahead by some distance. I can't see the most recent announcements on universal credit changing that. But as you say, it's not completely outside the realms of possibility that a Sydney Opera House type solution solves all of the problems.
It is interesting, though, because, you know, welfare, like the NHS, seems to be one of those issues where the Labour Party can be ahead even when what they're promising is incredibly unspecific and sometimes not as generous. I mean, actually, at the last election, the Labour Party didn't promise to reverse the welfare cuts. You know, sort of famously amongst, you know, our sort of geeky circles, but the general public think they're more generous on welfare. You know, as on the NHS, you know, in 2015, they didn't pledge the £8 billion that Simon Stevens was asking for the NHS, but everyone still thinks the Labour Party is more generous on health. So it's very interesting that should continue.
Well, it's one of those cases in public opinion terms where it's easier just to be the opposition and say, no, we're not that. And then you get the benefit of the public.
Now, I was just going to say, sorry, I made a weird noise when you mentioned that, but it is something I feel really strongly about. The way how Labour in 2017 basically argued for ages, oh yeah, so, you know, like reversing benefit cuts was not in a manifesto. But like, obviously, because it was really so obvious we were going to do it, so, you know, basically didn't need to put it in the manifesto.
But it's like John McDonnell, sort of the morning after the budget, saying, yes, we'll honour those tax cuts, isn't it?
You know, so weird.
It's really interesting because clearly the Labour, I mean, both parties have got this really interesting sort of tussle between what they need to do to match the other side and to kind of neutralise those offers and then the things that sets them apart. And you kind of want McDonnell to sort of even sort of admit, or at least somebody in the Labour Party somewhere to say, oh God, okay, well, we'll have to carry on with those tax cuts because we do want to win an election. But our priorities are still X, Y and Z. But of course, they'd never do that.
Speaking of nightmares, it's Halloween.
I'm terrified.
Halloween. We have data from 2013 on this. Marie, will you be celebrating Halloween this year?
Well, I went to a Halloween party on Saturday, and hopefully I will go to another Halloween party on Saturday. It is my favourite day of the year, basically.
Oh,
I don't like
Christmas.
We'll count
that as a definite yes.
Yeah, obviously.
Miranda, what about you?
Oh, God. Well, I have a really sweet tooth, so I quite enjoy eating all of the toffees that my kids bring back from trick-or-treating, but I hate them going trick-or-treating. I will clearly have to trail round the streets with two small children with whitened faces and bits of fake blood.
Oh, right. So I was going to say, you whitened faces, not because they're cold.
No, just because they're my children and I treat them mean, Joe. No, they love it. They've been working up to this for weeks. We've been practicing the makeup. It's all totally tedious. I cannot bear it.
What percentage of people, admittedly this is in 2013, but I can't imagine the data will have changed that much. What percentage of British people do you think would prefer trick-or-treaters to come to their door?
Two. Don't you turn the lights off and lie down on the floor? That's what I do.
I do that every night. Marie, what do you think? As a fan of Halloween,
Think? No, I'm not going to give free stuff to kids. Like, no, so, like, I don't know, 10%?
23%, actually.
Generous.
You still get 7 out of 10 saying, I would prefer trick-or-treaters not to come to my door. Only 10% of people say they will be wearing makeup, costume, or dressing up in fancy dress.
Only 10%?
Admittedly, as you can imagine, there is quite an age difference on this. A third of 18 to 24-year-olds back in 2013 said that they were going to be dressing up, compared to only 3% of the over-60s. Which, yeah, exactly. Make of that what you will. The 3% of over-60s that dress up in a costume for Halloween.
Enthusiastic grandparents, you have to admit, assume, no?
Oh, we did, yeah. Remember, like, my grandparents made us really bloody steak and nettle pasta for Halloween once, which was dope.
Wow.
I just really love Halloween.
That's it for this week, Miranda. Thank you so much for coming in. Next week, we have our American special, sort of live from the United States, if we can only get everything sorted out. Unfortunately, there's no time for our interview with Philip Green. But just before we go, a quick look at the things I did to prepare for the National Swimming Championships this weekend.
Oh.
Thank you to Subject Bakshi. This episode was sponsored by Smarkets. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us. And do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled PODOTPODS.com.